This is Investigative Poetics, and I'm series creator Even Christine Gardner. Today I'm in the studio with Jason Brown. He's an audio engineer and audiobook producer at BMA Audio. Please join us for a candid conversation that will take you inside the investigation.
Hi, Even.
Hi, Jason.
Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thanks for having me in your studio.
Yeah, I was really shaken by the last episode, but I like being shaken. I love all the tarot stuff. I love tarot. The contents are really intense and riveting, but I've got to ask, why are you putting this out there?
Well, I've been holding on to this for a long time, but I have always had this feeling that there is a family out there who's looking for someone, who's looking for this little girl. I'm telling the story because I think it feels like the right thing to do, you know. If there's someone, if I can bring someone some element of peace, some element of resolution, some solace, some closure, if I can help someone solve the mysteries of their lives and thereby solve the mystery of my life.
And missing children like that, it's almost epidemic in this country. On Native American reservations, you got all this epidemic of missing girls. Oh. I mean, I just read in globalmissingkids.org website that in Australia, 20,000 children are reported missing every year. In Germany, 100,000. In India, 96,000. United Kingdom, almost 113,000. And the U.S. here tops it all with 460,000 children reported missing every year by the FBI. It's insane. And how many people know about this? And you're addressing it.
Well, I mean, one of the challenges that I've run into in my research is that there isn't necessarily a case that's in the public record that directly corresponds to events as I remember them. However, not everything is in the public record. And there are lots of people and different populations whose stories get swept under the rug. The reason I undertook this whole project was because I have this mystery sort of at the center of my life, which is, you know, what happened the summer that I was 11 years old? What happened in the summer of 1993? Did my father harm another child? Did my father, did this child die? You know, I have this sort of looming sense that weighs on me very heavily, and a sense of responsibility to
make people come forward. Maybe how many cases go unreported?
Well, you know, I don't know. I know that cases do go unreported, but I do know that we have a responsibility to each other to tell the truth.
And what you're wondering is why, if he did indeed do it, we don't know yet.
Did it happen? Yeah.
Why? Why did he do that? You know, you're just wondering what when you get in the mind of somebody like that, it's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, there's no way to
do it.
Yeah, there's no way to reconcile that. There's no way to understand why someone would do something like that. But it is important to know. So I spent, you know, decades of my life in very direct, intimate relationship with someone whose actions and motives were to me utterly inexplicable. Yeah. And there's no way to understand why he did what he did. There's no way to understand why anyone would do those things. But there is something that I don't know exactly how to say this, that I in some way gained from some sort of knowledge of human nature that I gained from that relationship, which it's not truly the darkness of human nature. It's more that the light is so much stronger than the dark, and that time does heal all wounds, and that the truth will set you free. So now I'm just going through a lot of cliches, but I believe, but yeah. I've earned them, Jason.
Sure,
I've earned
yeah.
these cliches.
Yeah, absolutely. You have every right to use those cliches. But I just find it amazing that you're exploring it now, diving into it, going back and looking at every little thing. I mean, it's a lot of people just don't do that. A lot of people bury it, and I think are the worst for it. They carry around this terrible feeling in them, and I think it causes all kinds of problems.
Yeah,
and you're sort of shining a light on it, as you said.
Yeah, and I certainly feel lighter since I undertook this project. You know, each episode is a personal journey for me. It's like re-examining the material, re-examining the events. But then once I've sort of worked through it and molded it into a narrative form and press play and put it out there, it's almost like it no longer matters. It's like I've released it to the universe in this way that's really amazing. It's like felt so heavy when I was carrying it alone, but now that I've put it out there, it's so much lighter.
Wow. It's, so you're unburdening this weight, essentially.
I mean, I hope I'm not burdening others with it.
Well, it's very creative. No, yeah. I mean, if you were just spewing it, sure, but you're doing it in such a creative, artistic way. And that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, I do think that writing has the power to transform and transmute.
Yeah.
We have... In writings, in art, we have the ability to take a raw material and shape it and form it and make it something else. And that's a big part of this project.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, why now? Why are you doing this now?
So I've been dealing with this for my whole adult life, and particularly this event. You know, there's a real internal conflict that I've really struggled with for much of my adult life, because for a long time I didn't know if my father was engaged in any sort of criminal activity, because it was so it was evident to me, but there was so much gaslighting within the family structure that I just thought I was crazy.
Oh.
And so it was sort of this great relief to me in some ways when his crimes in education came to light, because I came to realize that I was not crazy, that everything that I had sort of suspected was true.
It must have been a relief.
And that's the double-edged sword that the narrator, that's me, is dealing with in this particular episode. You know, we're in the middle of season two, and she's confronting this mystery at the center of her life. Did she or did she not witness a terrible crime, a terrible violent crime when she was 11 years old? And what I've struggled with my whole life is either this happened, and it's like so horrifying,
yeah,
or like I invent, or I'm crazy. You know, or I just like invented, this is some sort of fabrication of the mind, some sort of madness. And so it's really, really been challenging for so long, because it's like I've been dealing with this sort of binary where both of those options are like horrible to deal with. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it sounds like 11, the age of 11 is when things started to dawn on you. It was this huge realization that things were very weird and strange.
It was more like a crisis of faith. But this particular situation is the reason why I undertook this whole project. This entire project, all of investigative poetics, is born of the necessity to face this particular question and crisis, which is at the center of this episode called Judgment, which is this question of what happened the summer I was 11 years old. And so everything, basically this whole project has been building to this revelation.
Well, it's amazing, because you think the whole podcast is going to be about his embezzlement and all that of the money, and all of a sudden, wham!
Yeah,
there's this too.
It's a little much.
Well, that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of it.
It's like,
and then you wonder, is it going to be something else? Wow. Who knows? This man is capable of anything.
Well, I think that it also sort of reflects the particular moment in time that we're living through, where we are confronted and faced with leaders and
false leaders.
Seemingly do anything, where there is no compunction, no moral compass, no. And so there is a way in which, on some level, I feel, how to put it, spiritually prepared.
Well, it must be odd to see this going on in politics, in society, and in your own realm, in your own family circle.
Yeah, well, what I've learned is that, you know, this sort of darkness will always consume and destroy itself. Which is not to say that there aren't very high costs and that people don't suffer. Yeah. People will suffer terribly. But I do, like, sort of on a deep fundamental level, believe that that energy is self-destructive and that it cannot sustain itself.
You think it would have to be.
Yeah.
It feeds on itself.
Yeah.
It feeds on itself. It thinks it's feeding on others, but really it's just self-consumptive, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah.
What steps have you taken towards resolving this 1993 case?
Well, I've done a lot of personal research. In 2020, I made an official report to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And over the course of the last year, I have conferred with police outside of Philadelphia and with the New York State Police. So I've been, you know, taking steps. I've talked to a lot of lawyers. But I think that the biggest steps that I've taken are in telling the story and making it public.
Have you had any feedback about people who this has maybe happened to as well? Or do you know of anybody else who this may have happened to?
Not exactly this scenario. However, over the course of the last 3 years, I have had many conversations with victims of my father's crimes, people who have been directly impacted by his actions.
Is that in the, that's in the podcast?
It is, not, those interviews, those conversations have deeply informed the writing, but they've been largely, research. They're not published conversations. But there is something very sort of transformative that has passed between us, in those, there's a strange intimacy that we share. And it's been life-changing for me to have those conversations.
And for them too, maybe.
I can't speak to that, but...
Also, this month marks a significant anniversary. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So the big reveal, or the big sort of climactic event that the first season of the first season of Investigative Poetics revolves around, is the September 2005 death of a bookkeeper at the Philadelphia Academy Charter School, which was my father's flagship school, around which he's sort of built this network of charter schools that he used to loot the school district of Philadelphia in the state of Pennsylvania. So season one, episode six, is called Complicit. And that episode details the circumstances, not exactly the circumstances, but details how I knew that my father was stealing and implicating me in his crimes, and how at the same time that I was beginning to push back against him, there was a tragic and suspicious, quote, suicide within the school community, and this individual who died, whose real name I have suppressed to respect his family, but who I refer to as John in the series, he died under very suspicious circumstances. And over the course of the past 3 years, I filed multiple right-to-know requests with the city of Philadelphia and the state of Pennsylvania and the Philadelphia Police Department in order to obtain more information surrounding his death.
Well, how did you know how to do that?
How did I know how to do it?
Yeah, make all these filings and requests, legal advice.
Well, I ask questions, and then I learn to do by doing. And I've had very little success with filing requests for information. They're like universally denied. Although I do have one appeal that's outstanding, and I'm hoping that some information will return to me. But what I have found is that people want to talk, that people have stories to tell, and that that this individual's death deeply impacted the community. and that a lot of people have questions about the circumstances surrounding his death. I spoke to a former colleague of his who literally described feeling his presence in the room. Like, she could feel him in the corner. She couldn't get his name off the door. I spoke with a man in his mid-30s who wept when we spoke about it. And I've always felt on some level that my father bore some responsibility for that man's death. And I want to know the truth of what happened. And I want his family to know the truth as well. Because as much as the truth hurts, it's something we can make peace with. It's the things that we don't know that haunt us. So essentially, I believe that what is done in the dark will come to the light. And this project, this endeavor, this crazy undertaking is about shining light in all the dark places.
That's beautiful. Now, listening to the podcast, it struck me that there's something intriguing about the story's structure. There are healing elements, there are dark elements, but something compelled you to listen. What are you doing to create that tension exactly, and how are you using the tarot as a structural tool?
Well, I love structure. I love form. I think that the having a constraint or a shape is very important, especially when you're trying to tell a story of this sort of rambling across decades, you know, pretty big story. So for the second season, I made the choice to base each episode on a tarot card. I have these beautiful images that my longtime friend and collaborator, Nicole Franco, has been commissioned. She's been creating these original tarot cards for each episode. And then, so each...
Yeah, they're gorgeous, actually.
Yeah, they're really special. She's a visual genius. So... What was I trying to say? Oh, structure and form. So the tarot card provides a visual structure, and each episode in this season revolves around a ritual. In case you've forgotten, the narrator, that's me, has enlisted the spiritual guidance of a storefront psychic who is guiding her through the reclamation of these sort of terrible memories through the use of these very arcane, very specific rituals. So each episode, like, there's a ritual like embedded in the story. Like the ritual in this episode is like the narrator is to bring a white sheet and several hundred dollars worth of quarters to the along with a cash payment of I forget how much the cash payment
very
was.
Mysterious.
The narrator, that's me, lay on the white sheet, and the fortune teller created a silver shield of coins around her to protect her.
Yeah. Oh, that's what they were for. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I love that magical element there.
Me too. I love magic.
It's a relief. Yeah. And you need a little magic.
Yeah.
You need a little help. From
the
spirit.
The narrator certainly needed quite a bit of help.
Yeah. Yeah. She took a lot upon herself.
Yeah.
But what I really liked is there's humor there too. Like, you're not sure you can trust this fortune teller. Well, you're not sure if she's a con, but as you mentioned, some things are working. So yeah. It gives you faith, but...
At what cost? And is it true? It's a good...
Yeah, that's great. It's a great little element, dynamic element there.
Yeah, I think she's a great character. Yeah. Like a fabulous character. Yeah. And, you know, the truth is stranger than fiction. I'd never be able to invent such a character.
Yeah, I think it's amazing that you keep trying to remind yourself that, oh, this person really exists. Truth is stranger than fiction, as you said. Do you see her anymore, this person? Can I go visit her? Does she take clients?
Does she take clients? I think she does still take clients. We haven't been in touch in a number of years, but we did keep in touch for a long time. And now I know that there was this real dramatic moment where, like, her psychic studio was, like, stripped to the studs and she moved out. Oh. And then, like, someone came in and, like, did it up, like, refurbished the studio. Like, just, like, it was a new psychic studio. Like, everything that was hers was taken out. And then, like, new stuff went in. And then the door was locked for, like, several years. And then...
Strange.
It was just there. It said open, but it was never open. And every now and again, I'd walk past, and it said it was open, but it was never open. But anyway, what's really interesting is that one day I went back with a friend who's a photographer to film the little opening sequence for season two. And the door opened.
Ooh.
It was like chills.
Oh, my God.
The door that had been locked for years had opened.
You can't make that up.
Oh. It was crazy.
Yeah. So she moved on and didn't give you a forwarding address?
I don't want to ruin the story, Jason.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Like, no spoilers. No spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
No spoilers.
I think it would be cool to go to her shop and say, I was listening to Investigative Poetics, and I just had to see you. It's a thing now.
Well, you know, maybe one of these days the podcast will blow up and, like, you know? Maybe Cher and I will go into business together.
Yeah, become an HBO hit.
Yeah.
So is there anything you want to share before we sign off today?
I do want people to know that if you or anyone you know has information pertaining to the events described in this or any of the episodes, that you can message me at contact@investigativepoetics.com. And I will follow any leads and any tips that you can provide.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I look forward to the next episode.
Thanks, Jason. Thank you so much for listening, for following this journey, and for your support of Investigative Poetics. Your patronage makes this project possible and helps solve the mystery. Stay tuned. A new episode will be coming soon. Investigative Poetics is written by Even Christine Gardner. The theme music is by Bobby and Max McVitie, with sound production by Michael Lesko, web design by Marco Jovic, art and graphics by Nicole Franco, and photography by Jeannie Tsai and Emily Dryden, with audio engineering by Jason Brown.